Okay, well, I want to start with the good stuff in a way. There's a whole series of things, and you know, I could have filled the talk up with all of these quotes about what Emma Goldman was like as an activist, as a speaker, and so on. But I think, you know, you can't help but sort of feel something for a person who is described by the mainstream media as she was considered a monster, an exponent of free love and bombs, and her name was enough in those days to produce a shudder. And she became famous as a great speaker. She was in fact described by one writer as the finest orator, man or woman, living. And this wasn't just one person's opinion, that literally thousands turned up to hear her denunciations of militarism, her denunciation of government, her denunciation of capitalism, or to hear her defence of atheism, of sexual freedom, or of homosexuality in a time when very few dared speak that word. In January 1919 in San Francisco, for example, she spoke for 2 weeks every night to 2,000 people each night. So, you know, she had some pulling power, she had some abilities, people wanted to hear this woman speak. She was undoubtedly courageous, she spoke out and organised, as I've indicated already, around many of the most important issues of her time. And like other radicals of the time, this is the late 19th and into the first part of the 20th century, she paid a price for speaking out. That she did prison time, and eventually she was exiled from the United States. So all of this is just to establish something about her personal qualities, because the purpose of this talk is actually not to look at her personal qualities. It's not her personal qualities that are at issue. In fact, instead, what we want to do is to determine if the ideology that she spent her whole life promoting, that is anarchism, provides a guide to action for people who want to change the world. And the conclusion that I'm going to draw, I'll tell you now the conclusion, her talents were wasted, and they were considerable talents. Her talents were wasted by the inadequacies of anarchist politics. I want to begin by talking a little bit about Goldman's revival in the 1960s and 1970s as a figure of some veneration around the left. Because Emma Goldman lived from 1869 to 1940, and after her death in 1940, she was a largely forgotten figure. And it wasn't really until the revival of the new left in the late 60s that interest was taken in her again. Now, this might seem a bit odd because she actually did live through incredibly momentous events. You know, she lived in a period when anarchism claimed a following in the tens of thousands, including thousands of workers. In the United States, where she spent a fair proportion of her early adult life, there was the Haymarket Affair of 1886, the origins of the first May Day, really, the assassination attempt on Henry Clay Frick during the Homestead Steel Strike of 1892, the growth of the industrial workers of the world, free speech fights around them, but also union organising by them, anti-conscription organising during the First World War, the Russian Revolution, and of course she lived through and played a role as a representative of anarchism in the Spanish Revolution in the 1930s. So all of this might make you think, well, you know, how come she got forgotten? And I think actually the main reason that she got forgotten was that anarchist politics had been put to the test and had failed that test. But in the 1960s and 70s, she was remembered. And her revival came with the adoption of her as a woman, as something of an icon by the feminist movement, but also the politics of the new left, that the new left developed very much explicitly in opposition to the old left, which was dominated by Stalinism, in opposition to communism, all of the authoritarianism, all of the kind of viciousness and anti-working class politics and reformism, really, in the United States and a range of other places, that didn't strike people who were being radicalized by the events of the 60s as having much to say to those who wanted to change the world in that period. And so she is revived because things about her kind of fit the things that are happening in the 60s and 70s. But I think also her revival starts to put in front of us, if you like, some of the selective memory about Goldman that is also, I think, a feature of those who want to make her an icon for the present. I think her adoption by the women's movement is a good example. She's a feminist hero, but people tend to ignore the fact that she opposed the fight for women's suffrage, for example. In the era of suffrage struggles, Goldman opposed the demand, and not just because of the conservative politics of many of the suffragettes, but because she saw nothing good in women gaining the right to participate in the state. She was an anarchist, after all, the right to vote, why should women want to have this, and so on. And she argued that all of this stuff about getting the vote was a diversion for fighting around issues of birth control. It's worth saying that massive numbers came to her talks on birth control in 1915 and 1916 against enormous attempts by the state and every moralist under the sun to demonise her for even daring to talk about it. But she said, The right of women to vote is a diversion from birth control. It's a diversion from organising women workers. Whereas, in fact, there was no contradiction between these things. And by saying, I'm not interested in the right to vote and so on, you end up sounding really just like the reactionaries who said, well, women shouldn't have the right to vote. It's not really a question. Instead, her solution, I think, and again, this indicates, I think, a number of things that we'll see as we go through some of her life, that her solution was individual. It was to begin with inner regeneration, individualism regarding women's emancipation via free love, deciding not to allow men, religion or the state to dictate their choices. But the reality was that for the mass of working class women, many of these questions involved no choice at all for them, that there simply wasn't possible to make this choice to liberate yourself. Okay, so I want to move back now to something about Goldman's early life. As I said, I'm not really that interested in the course of the talk of going through all the things, you know, all the ins and outs of her personal life. And, you know, one of the things I think is something that women political figures, whatever their politics, there's always this horrible thing of we should be interested in all the ins and outs of their domestic arrangements and how many lovers they had and all this other sexist garbage. Well, not having any of that. So Goldman was born into a Jewish family in Lithuania, then part of the Tsarist Empire in 1869. Her family were a small business people. They lost their business and she was forced into factory work at the age of 13, and she emigrated to the United States at 16 in order to try and find work and, you know, help the family out and so on. Other members of her family had already gone there, and she arrived at a time when anarchist politics was, you know, quite widespread amongst sections of the working class and others. So the early part of her life. Well, one of the things that had happened was that, as I said, the Haymarket affair, the attempt to frame up anarchists for a bombing that took place, an attack on working class organisation, it had driven a lot of anarchist activity underground, but it was still possible for people to speak and so on. And Goldman came into contact with Johann Most, who was the leading anarchist of the day, and he really promoted her as a speaker. The first speeches that she gave, and I think this is indicative again of something quite common as a thread through her politics, the first speeches that she gave under his influence were about, this is a quote, about the waste of energy and time the 8-hour struggle involved, scoffing at the stupidity of the workers who fought for such trifles. And in fact, she went on to say, the fight for a shorter workday served, again a quote, only to distract the masses from the real issue, the struggle against capitalism, against the wage system for a new society. And I think, and this illustrates an important aspect of her politics throughout her life. On the one hand, ultra-leftism, that the actual demands of actual struggles are not good enough. On the other hand, elitism, that the dumb masses just really don't get it. Instead, she was much more an exponent of something that was popular in anarchist circles at the time, and I think still has many echoes in those who proclaim anarchism of some kind today, the idea of the propaganda of the deed, that the heroic act of an individual would inspire the normally complacent masses to rise up and strike a blow against their oppressors. And what this meant was shown in practice in 1892. It was a major strike that year. The Carnegie Steel Trust, as part of a worldwide global financial crisis, global recession, in 1892, the Carnegie Steel Trust cut the wages of its workers at the Homestead Works near Pittsburgh, and their attempt to cut the wages generated a great strike. How did the anarchists respond to this? Well, first off, they put out a leaflet that was a flaming call to the men of Homestead to throw off the yoke of capitalism, to use their present struggle as a stepping stone to the destruction of the wage system. Well, so far, it doesn't sound too bad. It's a piece of concrete propaganda, perhaps. You want to make, there's people fighting back, capitalism's in crisis, you want to make an argument that this says something about the wages system, about capitalism as a whole. So the leaflet, you know, maybe it's a bit abstract, a bit far-fetched, doesn't really connect, but there's nothing that objectionable about it. However, things moved on quite quickly. Pinkerton thugs and strikebreakers, under the direction of the plant manager, a man called Henry Clay Frick, opened fire on the strikers. They killed 7 of them and wounded many more. The anarchists came up with a plan. I think the workers are on strike. They want to defend their wages against the wage cut. Now this guy's sick the strikebreakers and the Pinkertons on them. We should show them that they need to become more revolutionary. And the way we'll show them is to hatch a plan to assassinate Frick. It didn't work at all. As you might imagine, the plan to assassinate Frick had a disastrous impact on the strike and on the anarchist movement. And I think its effect was summed up by Hugh O'Donnell, who was the leader of the strike, who said, "It would seem that the bullet from Berkman's pistol," Berkman was the anarchist, a lifetime collaborator of Goldman's, "it would seem that the bullet from Berkman's pistol, failing in its foul intent, went straight through the heart of the homestead strike." And so far from generating more revolutionary upheavals from the workers, actually this propaganda of the deed simply said, "We are going to do this for you." And in fact, the workers showed themselves not to be very grateful at all. Now, while Goldman later dropped her support for assassinations to spur the masses, that particular aspect of the tactic, in other words, she never gave up the idea that heroic individuals and not masses made history. And that was really the underlying idea of the assassination attempt. Here you've got a massive strike of workers trying to take on the bosses, defend themselves collectively and so on. The anarchists basically sidelined all of that in order to promote this idea of heroic individuals making history. And in her aptly named 1910 essay called Minorities versus Majorities, Emma Goldman wrote, "Always, at every period, the few were the banner bearers of a great idea of liberating effort, not so the mass, the leaden weight of which does not let it move." So there's obviously an argument about that some people, there will always be leaders, that there will be unevenness and struggles and so on, but it's quite clear from the second part of that statement that this idea that the masses are this leaden weight that does not allow movement. And so there's a kind of contradiction, isn't there, then in anarchism, that this leads anarchism from anti-authoritarianism into its mirror opposite, a view of revolt as the privileged act of the enlightened few, basically imposing their enlightenment on the unenlightened masses. And again, a quote from Minorities versus Majorities. "The multitude, the mass spirit, dominates everywhere, destroying quality. The majority cannot reason, it has no judgment. Lacking utterly in originality and moral courage, the majority has always placed its destiny in the hands of others. I therefore believe with Emerson that the masses are crude, lame," this is a quote from Emerson, "the masses are crude, lame, pernicious in their demands and influence, and need not to be flattered, but to be schooled. I wish not to concede anything to them, but to drill, divide, and break them up." In other words, the living, vital truth of social and economic well-being will become a reality only through the zeal, courage, the non-compromising determination of intelligent minorities, and not through the mass. And so, you know, there's a sense in which the conclusion, you look at what's the logic of this, the conclusion for anarchists like Goldman is identical to that of the conservatives: opposition to mass democratic control from below, that the working class can't and shouldn't rule. And if you look in this earlier period of Goldman's life, you see some quite clear opposition, I think, between the kind of things that the anarchists did and the way in which those who were attempting to build socialist organisation approached these questions. So Goldman was at odds, for example, with the attempts of working class organisers like Eugene Debs to try and break from the capitalist parties and to form a socialist party that would reach a mass audience of workers. Now, it's not like the Socialist Party was anything to write home about. Let's not, you know, try and gild that lily. Much of what Goldman said about the Socialist Party was actually true. And it was her critiques of it, its conservatism, its hodgepodge of incoherent ideas and so on, from the elections were the answer right through to revolutionary ideas, that her critique of much of the problems with the Socialist Party were criticisms that were often made by the left within the Socialist Party. many of whom became the base of the Communist Party after the Russian Revolution. One of them described the Socialist Party as a socialist variety store, which I thought was quite a good summary of the hodgepodge of politics. But there's a difference between Goldman on the one hand and the left inside the Socialist Party, where the left made these points to win wider layers of workers within the Socialist Party to its positions and later to the necessity of forming an explicitly revolutionary party. Goldman used them to attack socialism in general. And again, I think that elitist disdain for the masses, even if you didn't like the Socialist Party as it existed, the idea that you could just ignore it, criticise it from outside, basically say anyone who thinks the Socialist Party is any good is a dupe. Well, there's a few figures that probably give you an idea why this is a mistaken approach. The Socialist Party grew to a membership of almost 120,000 in 1912, the same year that Eugene Debs won just under a million votes when he stood for the presidency of the United States. The Appeal to Reason, the party's best-read newspaper, had a circulation at this point of 600,000. And I think that if you compare, and we'll have a look in a minute at some of the work that Emma Goldman was doing in terms of trying to generate anarchist propaganda and so on, that the relative influence of socialism and anarchism in the first decade of the 20th century perhaps gives us some indication of the degree to which the two sets of politics addressed the real questions that faced ordinary people at the time. You know, just as the assassination of Henry Clay Frick didn't really address the real concerns of the strikers in the Homestead strike, nor did the other things that Emma Goldman was engaged in. I want to make a slight diversion here to talk a little bit about the social milieu in which she did work. Although she had nothing but, I think, ill-concealed, and perhaps not concealed at all, contempt for the project of the Socialist Party and its attempt to reach the masses of workers, that she moved in other circles that are worth saying a little bit about. The period that Goldman was editing Mother Earth, her newspaper, which was from 1906 to 1918, coincided with the height of her popularity. She spoke before audiences in the hundreds and, as I said initially, often audiences of thousands on anarchist theory, on modern drama, on women's emancipation and other issues. But she addressed a different audience to those that the left of the Socialist Party was trying to reach. This was a time when liberal and radical ideas were in the ascendance. I don't mean just left-wing, working-class socialist ideas. I mean all kinds of radicalism relating to all kinds of social forces. Liberal and radical ideas were in the ascendant in this early period of the 20th century. The Socialist Party grew because these ideas affected the working class as well, and the industrial workers of the world engaged in its most important battles. Although Goldman defended the industrial workers of the world and raised money for them, she made no attempt to build a working class organisation or to intervene systematically into the class struggle. Instead, the life of many anarchists, and it was very much the circles in which Goldman moved, tended to operate within a somewhat more self-contained world that wanted to live anarchism by example. And there were, in fact, a network of anarchist enclaves which tended to dwindle in size as the immigrant founders aged. This was part of the world that Goldman inhabited, but the other part of it was the bohemian life of middle-class liberals centred around Greenwich Village. Greenwich Village had become, as probably still got this reputation, I guess it certainly had when I was young, as a centre of kind of bohemian radicalism. And this was a reputation that it began to develop in the early part of the 20th century. That the bohemian life of Greenwich Village, for one example, the Liberal Club, which would have been a kind of a place for slumming it, really, for middle-class radicals, those who are well off but felt something for the lower orders. And it was the site of an organisation called the Liberal Club. And the Liberal Club, which had been drawing in these middle-class radicals for some time, by 1912, was a sign of the radicalism of the period, was rent by dissension over two questions. The first was whether or not to admit blacks, and the second was whether or not to admit Emma Goldman. Again, something to her credit. But this bohemian life was something that had no real connection to the struggles of the masses. I think, you know, perhaps summed up, you can imagine the kind of frisson of sort of scared delight of a middle-class person slumming it in Greenwich Village, where they would go to Polly's Village restaurant, where you might be served by an anarchist waiter who sneered bourgeois pigs as he slammed the trays down before you. But yeah, some disconnection from the kind of things that I was talking about earlier. And Goldman operated through most of her political life as a political freelancer. Her fabulous speeches, for example, were given in the service not of building any organisation in particular. In fact, until her work during the Spanish Civil War, she didn't speak as a representative of a particular anarchist organisation besides her own magazine. She spoke in support of the IWW, but she was not trying to build an organisation in the way that Eugene Debs, who was also a considerable orator, his speeches were all directed towards trying to build an organisation. And one of the IWW leaders, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, though impressed by what she called the force, eloquence and fire that poured forth from this woman, expressed disappointment that Goldman developed into a lecturer for the entertainment of wealthy liberals. Even her fellow anarchist Alexander Berkman criticised her because, as he said, lectures for outside and chance audiences did not build a movement. Okay, well, I'm running through time, so I better get a move on. Goldman took a stand against conscription in the United States when the US entered the war. She was jailed for 2 years from 1917, and when she was let out of jail, the US deported her back to Russia in 1919 as part of a sort of anti-Red scare that was going on at the time, obviously because of what had happened in Russia 2 years previously. And what was Goldman's attitude to the Russian Revolution? Well, actually, she'd initially welcomed the victory of the Bolsheviks, but she didn't change any of her political ideas, as many other radicals had, that the kind of rethinking of what is it that the Bolsheviks have done and why have they played this role in leading the working class to power in Russia did not cause her to rethink any of her political ideas. Her support for the Russian Revolution, I think, was very largely that the US ruling class hated them, so she was for them. And you contrast this with the rethinking of the best of the anarchists, the anarcho-syndicalists whose libertarian ideas were most connected to workers' struggles. A whole series of them joined the communist parties in the United States, people like Elizabeth Gurley Flynn that I mentioned before, Lucy Parsons, Big Bill Haywood, and thousands of rank-and-file IWW members joined the Communist Party under the impact of the Russian Revolution. It made them think these Bolsheviks are onto something. So before leaving the United States, Goldman had published a number of pro-Bolshevik articles and pamphlets, one called In Defense of the Bolsheviks, pretty clear. And when she and other political prisoners arrived in Russia at the beginning of 1920, they were greeted warmly by the Bolsheviks. They met all the leading figures of the revolution. The revolutionary government was eager to enlist their help in the construction of the new socialist order in Russia. But Goldman's support for the Russian Revolution didn't last all that long. She wrote two books, and they've got dreadful titles, but I must say in her defence that she didn't come up with the titles. The titles were come up with by the bourgeois publishers, who were very glad of what she wrote. The books were called My Disillusionment in Russia and My Further Disillusionment in Russia. And she writes in them about how many anarchists that she met in Russia after the revolution, many anarchists told her that they had concerns about the degeneration of the revolution. Well, let's face it, the leaders of the Bolsheviks had many concerns about the degeneration of the revolution at this point. But many anarchists had told her that their concerns about what was going wrong, because the revolution was trying to hang on in isolation in backward Russia, that they regarded these things as minor matters compared to defending the revolution against the counter-revolution then at its throat, that they wanted to work with the revolution. And I think Victor Serge, who came from an anarchist background himself, who threw his lot in with the Bolsheviks after the revolution, summed up, I think, very well the path that anarchists could go on. He wrote that anarchists would find themselves either trailing behind the more determined communists or following the footsteps of reaction. And yet, Goldman was not prepared to rethink her politics. She was not prepared to trail behind the more determined communists. In fact, when it came to a question of things that she didn't like about the revolution and the counter-revolution, she was prepared to basically go the whole hog and say, well, the revolution really was misconceived from the outset. This is a problem and it's all the Bolsheviks' fault. To her, the civil war to defend the revolution was merely the excuse that the Bolsheviks used to unmask their real agenda. Now, get ready for some real originality here. Or she put it in the preface to My Disillusionment, an insignificant minority bent on creating an absolute state is necessarily driven to oppression and terrorism. Now, you might remember that earlier thing I read, that essay of hers, Minorities and Majorities. Well, here the minorities are the bad guys. Of course, the problem is that the majority are, in fact, the working class of Russia, and they don't, once again, get much of a look in. The capitalist press, of course, then trumpeted her denunciations of the Bolsheviks throughout the 1920s, and in a way, kind of the way that I think that the mainstream media so much loves Christopher Hitchens, this idea one of them has seen that, they've seen the error of their ways or whatever. But the final thing I want to talk about, and I think this is in some ways the most important in terms of going through some of the political issues that Goldman's politics, the politics of anarchism, is not unique to her, but where her life illustrates the weakness of anarchist politics, and that's the Spanish Revolution. Because we have to say that wherever anarchists have not simply abstained from struggle for the sake of purity, they've been forced to severely compromise their ideas and, in fact, ended up on the wrong side in revolutionary struggles. The Spanish Revolution of 1936 represented, in many ways, I think, the high tide of anarchism's influence anywhere in the world. The anarchist-dominated CNT, the National Confederation of Workers, embraced a huge section of Spanish workers who were inspired by its vision of militant direct action. When General Franco led a military revolt against the popular government, the elected government of the Spanish Republic, the workers of Spain, especially around Barcelona, rose up in self-defense. They armed themselves, but they didn't just arm themselves. It wasn't just a military conflict. They began to take over land. They began to take over the factories, to boot out the bosses, to start to operate in the way that workers in revolutionary situations again and again have operated. And at least initially, this working class revolution thwarted Franco's assault throughout much of Spain. In Barcelona in particular, workers effectively controlled the city. But what did the anarchist leadership do? Well, heedful of their principles, of course, they were against states, they were against state power and so on, so they refused it. And I'll read you an account of this because I think it really sums it up. Both it tells you something that Companys, who was the president of Catalonia, he had their number, but also it says a lot about the anarchist leaders' politics when faced with an actual revolutionary situation. They have this meeting with Companys. Things are going badly for him and going very well for the revolutionary workers. And Companys congratulates them on their victory. He says, "You are the masters of the town and of Catalonia because you defeated the fascist soldiers on your own. You have won and everything is in your power. You do not need me. If you do not want me as president, say so now and I shall become just another soldier in the anti-fascist struggle." As it turned out, the leaders of the CNT did want him. They agreed to go on with the collaboration. They agreed to Companys' offer. The anarchist leader, Santillán, explained the CNT's reasoning. "We could have remained alone, declared the generalship null and void, and imposed the true power of the people in its place." So they kind of knew what was on offer. "But we did not believe in dictatorship when it was being exercised against us, and we did not want it when we could exercise it ourselves only at the expense of others." And let's remind ourselves who the others are. This is the ruling class. This is the government, the capitalist class, the people that they have defeated effectively in the workplaces and so on, but we can't exercise a dictatorship, so we must not take power. But subsequently, not only did the anarchist leaders abdicate power to the existing government, they tossed their principles aside and then became participants in a government, the Popular Front government that placated the capitalists and landowners and that systematically began disarming the working class movement in the name of anti-fascist unity. And Emma Goldman was closely connected to all of this. This is not just, oh, well, these foolish anarchists in Spain, they made these mistakes. Goldman was very closely connected to this because she spent these years as the CNT FAI's chief English language spokesperson. And I think in doing so, she illustrated all the limitations and problems of anarchism, especially when faced with the revolution. And when else do you want your politics to be worthwhile? For the first time in half a century, Goldman was now working under a certain amount of political discipline, something that she hadn't done, as I said, in her previous political activities. She was answering to the CNT FAI in Spain. And as their English language spokesperson, she managed to organise some successful meetings and rallies for the Spanish Revolution in Britain. But she also ran into some conflict with the leaders in Spain, whose role as collaborators in the bourgeois government led them increasingly to toe the government line. And so think what was the Propio Front government's line? Well, for example, to contribute, their strategy was to curry favours with foreign governments, that they felt that the way forward for the revolution was for Britain or France to intervene, not for the revolution, for the anti-fascist struggle, sorry, no revolutions here, that for Britain or France to intervene on the side of the Republic. And so in order to curry favours with those foreign governments, the anarchists in Spain stressed the revolution's moderation. It refrained from criticising the Communist Party, the Stalinists, whose patron in Russia was sending aid to the Republic because that might dry up if they had any political criticisms of them. And it slapped down anarchists outside of Spain who saw in the CNT-FAI's dealings in this way as betrayals of anarchism. And so Goldman was kind of pulled in two directions, and her biographer, Alex Wexler, has a nice little passage about this, which I'll read. She says, she pursued a confused and contradictory course, now ardently defending the Spanish comrades, now criticising what she called their naivety, even in the New York Times, which needed no convincing. Now minimising the evils of the Republic in comparison with the potential catastrophe of a nationalist victory, now denouncing the Republic as a Stalinist dictatorship. So you can see this pressure on both sides. At one moment, she argued that democracy was only another name for fascism. At another moment, she insisted that fascism was much the worst, that one could at least breathe in a democratic republic. She would conclude the necessity of common action with the communists and then denounce collaboration with the communists as a betrayal. Those who criticised CNT-FAI strategy, to those who criticised CNT-FAI strategy, she offered a passionate defence. To those who defended them, she offered criticism. So you see there's this kind of pull on both sides. And yet, ultimately, what did she do? What side did she come down on? She ended up coming down on the side of defending what the anarchists in Spain were doing. And this, even though this led her into conflict, she was in conflict with the British anarchist support groups. Their anarcho-syndicalist members criticised what was going on in Spain. Emma Goldman's role was to defend what the anarchists in Spain were doing, both in terms of their refusal to take power when the working class was actually in the saddle, as George Orwell put it, in Catalonia, but also to defend their involvement in the Popular Front government. And it's worth reminding ourselves one of the ministries that the anarchists took in the Popular Front government was, of course, the Ministry of Labour, the one about controlling the working class. And so she clashed, as I said, with British anarchist support groups, the International Anarchist Organisation, the International Working People's Association in Paris in 1937. Again, she defended what was going on in Spain against their opposition. In fact, when you think about it, she repeated most of the same defences for the Spanish Republican policy that the Stalinists had raised. For example, against those who criticised the anarchist support for the professionalisation of the Republican army and the militarisation of the revolution, that is, taking it away from a social revolution to being just a military conflict, for those who criticised this, she concluded that this was necessitated by the need to combat the stronger fascist forces. And in her words, these actions were not of their making or choosing. They were imposed upon them by the development of the struggle. Now, this might sound a bit familiar. Think back to the Russian Revolution and what the arguments that she had there. In other words, she was repeating here the same arguments that people such as Victor Serge had made about the Russian Revolution. In relation to the Russian Revolution, she dismissed these arguments, but in defence of the bourgeois Popular Front government in Spain, she thought these arguments were perfectly adequate. Because I think the important distinction is, of course, that Serge's arguments were in the service of maintaining a revolutionary workers' government in the face of attack, not a justification for joining a capitalist government. Okay, I've almost finished. Okay, and I think all of the problems of anarchism when faced with revolution are kind of writ large here. They could remain irrelevant to the struggle and true to their principles, as they did when Compagne said, well, you've beaten me, do you want to run things? No. Or they could junk their principles to become relevant, which is obviously the argument for the, under which they joined the Popular Front. And however uneasy she was about all of this, Emma Goldman defended the Spanish anarchists' abandoning of any of these principles. But Goldman never reflected, once again, just as with the Russian Revolution, on whether her principles had failed in Spain, whether anarchist politics had failed. After the defeat, she wrote to a friend, offering an explanation that hopefully by this stage, as I'm about to finish, will sound a bit familiar. Why had things been set back so much in Spain? Her words, "In a measure, we are paying for our belief that the masses as such can bring about fundamental change. There never was a more proletarian revolution than the Spanish one, but there was a terrible poverty in great minds and strength of character. That was the real tragedy of Spain." And I think in a period when real-world revolutionary events put anarchist theories to the test, as they did in Spain, most spectacularly, they so clearly failed. And therefore, the conclusion I said at the beginning, what my conclusion was, those seeking to genuinely challenge capitalism must reject anarchism and commit themselves instead to revolutionary Marxism, the politics of mass democratic struggle of workers to collectively transform society. That's possible. The anarchist utopia is not.